Okay, this is the hour. We'll take your phone calls with Joshua P. Warren. So get ready to make them as we talk about Santa Claus and ghost stories. And we're back with Joshua P. Warren, of course, as we want your Santa Claus stories, if you've seen Santa or a ghost story during the holiday season. What do you think's more prevalent, Josh, the ghost stories or seeing Santa Claus?
Well, you know, I think the ghostly stuff is more prevalent, and that's because there are just more of them. And also, you know, people have an easier time, frankly, believing they're seeing a ghost or some other type of, you know, demonic creature, whatever you want to call it, versus Santa Claus, because Santa Claus is associated so much with a childhood fantasy. But let me give you, you know, another example of how you might want to look back through history and sort of view this phenomenon differently. I've been talking about the Gargula because it's a creature I've been investigating intensely this year here in Puerto Rico that has been seen by very credible witnesses, six policemen, and I actually went and interviewed policemen. I'm talking about, you know, they were a school teacher, you know, people who have been known and for forever in this area. This is a very real, tangible creature that's about 6 feet tall with these bat-like wings flying around and seen mainly around the holidays. Well, you know what? That reminds you of Mothman, doesn't it?
It sure does, yeah.
And remember how that story turned out? The big climax of the Mothman sightings in 1967 was the collapse of the Silver Bridge.
That's right.
On December the 15th.
There was always a tragedy surrounding that sighting.
Yes, and you know, that was Christmas time. There were all these people who were on this bridge and cars loaded down with gifts from Christmas shopping. And when that bridge collapsed and 46 people died, it was even spookier because you saw the people there dying with these Christmas or intended Christmas presents floating around the water. So again, another way of viewing the connection between some of these dark beings that may show up around the holidays, and I don't know if they create some of these tragedies, but they're certainly associated with them, and they are much more prevalent than people have probably realized.
Josh, I want to go back for a moment before we get to calls on these cursed gifts. First of all, what would possess somebody to send somebody a cursed gift? Why do they want to hurt them?
Well, you know, most cursed gifts are just passed along innocently, inadvertently. And that's because, you know, if you find some antique object especially that seems to be in good shape, it's sort of a classy thing to give to someone else as a gift. It's a little bit different than just, you know, running to Walmart and buying some new off-the-shelf product that anybody could go get. I mean, so usually when somebody gives somebody an item that's cursed, it's not because they are intentionally trying to hurt that person. On the other hand, it sure is a good opportunity for someone to do that, especially if they're in a situation where they're trying to, you know, keep their enemies closer, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so if you have a problem with somebody else, and you go out and you find a cursed thing and you pass that along to them, it can be used as a weapon. Now, that certainly does happen. And, you know, it's funny. I got contacted just maybe 3 months ago from a guy I know fairly well who also happens to be a police officer. And a lot of my friends are in law enforcement, which is great because they get to see all the really crazy stuff, and then they, you know, tell me about it behind the scenes. But this police officer, he says, he contacted me and he goes, "Man, I woke up yesterday, went outside my house, and this was on my porch." And he sent me a picture of this, I guess you would call it, sort of like a door knocker, but it was this really sort of grotesque kind of green man type of face with the, you know, arched eyebrows and the sardonic grin and the long nose. And I mean, it was just it was a very well done, but really ghoulish looking thing that had just magically appeared on his doorstep. And he said, I don't know. He says, I have no clue where this came from. And he said, I don't know what I should do with it. And I said, okay, well, first off, let's let a few days go by just so you can make sure that nobody pops up with an explanation like, oh, I came by and I wanted to give this to you, but you weren't home. You know, so a few days went by. There was still no explanation. And so at that point, he said, I don't know what to do with this thing. And I said, well, if I were you, I would just get rid of it. I said, you don't feel good about it, do you? He says, no. I said, well, what have you done with it? He goes, I brought it into my living room. Oh, that's the worst thing you can do. If there's an object like that just appears, if you bring it into your living
room. You invite it, basically, right?
It's like inviting the vampire in.
Yeah.
When you acquiesce and you allow something to enter your personal space, well, now you not only have to get rid of it, but you need to go through a process to try to restore the energy of your personal space. So you know, there are all kinds of ways in which this sort of thing can happen. But most of these things just get passed around from person to person, and they don't even have any idea that it's a cursed object.
Let's go to the phones now with you, Joshua. Let's start by going to Robert in Long Island, New York. Happens to be a first-time caller. Hey, Robert. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Great.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
You too.
I just want to say I listen to your show every night during my route. I drive for a living, so
thank you.
Help me get through the night.
Appreciate it.
I had seen Santa Claus, what I think was Santa. I was no more than 10, 12 years old. My mother worked retail. She was a manager, so I had gone off on Christmas Eve, so she had to go to the mall to shut everything off, and I was home by myself, and I heard a bunch of noise on the roof, so I went outside to investigate to see what was going on, and I saw what I think was Santa up on the roof. I didn't see a sleigh, I didn't see any reindeer, but I saw a very tall, fat man in a red outfit on my roof. So I ran inside, I went to go get a Polaroid camera, because it's all I had when I was younger, And when I came back out, it was gone.
Do you think it was Santa, Robert?
It was a two-story house, so I don't know who else would have been on my roof. Yeah,
exactly, especially in the dead of winter. You know, Josh, I've got to say this, that I heard once when I was a kid what I thought were stomping sounds of feet on the roof during Christmas, or hoofs of a reindeer. Something was up there thumping around on the roof of our house on Christmas Eve night. And to this day, like that song Scarlet Ribbons, which we're going to play tomorrow night, I have no idea what it was. None. How do you explain that?
Well, you know, it seems like that's one of the most common characteristics that people talk about. They hear the thumping on the roof. And by the way, it's really interesting that Robert was calling from Long Island, because one of the experiences that I related earlier in the show happened in Long Island. So, you know, maybe that's one of his favorite, no pun intended, stomping grounds. But nonetheless, you know what's weird about all this is that a tulpa is something that you might think of as being sort of phantasmal, but actually they're not at all. They seem to have a very dense sort of physical build during the limited period of time in which they appear. So that means that, you know, you don't think of the traditional ghost as being able to run around and stomp on your roof, because you think that the ghost doesn't have that much material, so to speak, within its body. On the other hand, tulpas can be very, very dense. And, I mean, if it's probable that Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster-type creatures, and a lot of these cryptids are tulpas, which is why that you can't catch them. Look at Bigfoot in particular.
Right.
Every single year, people in every single state of the United States say they've seen Bigfoot. And you've got folks running around all over the place with thermal imaging and everything else, you know, with a lot on the line trying to catch this thing or just get a dead body, and they can't do it. So we either have to say, well, all these people are either, you know, being misled, or they're lying, or it's a hoax or something like that, or this is not some kind of a normal biological creature. And I think that most of them happen to be tulpas, because that, to me, is a more realistic explanation than the, than that we have some kind of big ape running around the country that we can't find. And so when people see Bigfoot, I mean, they don't describe Bigfoot as being some kind of a phantasmal, sort of semi-transparent form. It looks like a very solid creature to them. And that's how most of these tulpas appear. They can even appear much more dense and solid than a typical ghost does. And that, I think, is because that they're so concentrated. And it calls into question the relationship between matter and energy that results in a creature existing altogether. It's kind of like looking at a human and saying, well, how much of the human is matter and how much of the human is energy? We don't have the answer to that question. We know that if we take a human being and we squeeze out all the water and empty space, there's just a tiny little blob of matter left over. So it seems clear that a lot of what's going on here has to do with the energy body, but we still don't know the connection. So that is to say, if we have a very condensed energy form, it might also create this sort of very tangible, corporeal type of physical form, and that's what makes it so tricky when we see these things sort of appear and then disappear as if they are ghosts, but they don't look ghostly when you see them.
Where did the myth of the elf come from?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question because, again, if we go back and we look at some of these sort of pagan traditions in Europe, which form the basis of what we now tend to celebrate in this country around Christmas time, elves around the Scandinavian areas in particular were believed to be protectors. These are creatures that, despite their mischievous reputation in some cases, were for the most part believed to sort of live in and around the walls of houses and actually be helpful. And you know what's weird is that if you think about this idea of spiritual evolution, it actually would kind of make sense that as time goes on and a species evolves into a more efficient form, that it becomes smaller, which is why, you know, we humans, we have this impression like, oh, well, we rule the world, you know, but actually we don't. Microorganisms rule our planet.
Well, it's interesting. High technology, the smaller you get, the better the technology. Like the phones. Remember your cell phones in the old days?
Yeah, absolutely. Which, of course, you know, look at the dinosaurs dying out one way or another.
Yeah. I mean,
part of that had to do with they were too big. So it makes sense that some of these more evolved, advanced creatures would actually be more diminutive, just like many of the aliens that people talk about seeing. And so, therefore, if these are creatures that have that are of some kind of higher spiritual caliber that have these abilities that we think of as magical, then it would make sense that they would actually be smaller, more efficient little beings. And so the idea of Santa having helpers that are elves comes directly from the idea that these beings that are elf-like also occupy kind of an angelic function, popping in and helping you when times are getting rough.
Let's go back to the calls. We'll go to Robert in North Carolina. Hey, Robert, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, I've been listening to you for a while, and I kind of keeps me awake coming home off late shift.
Good.
But I can't verify his story of Germington. I live in King, North Carolina, but I grew up in Winston-Salem, so I know the whole story. And to this day, there's still people that speculate exactly what happened, why he went mad. It's almost like the story off of Payne Road in Rule Hall. But, you know, it's just kind of weird for me. It kind of, I don't know, I get excited when I hear people talk about things that happen around in my neck of the woods.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
But as far as Santa Claus, never seen him. You know, I thought when I was a kid I seen Rudolph. Of course, you know, it turned out to be a plane. But now as far as cursed items, I believe my grandmother had received a cursed mirror. It'd been years ago.
Who would have sent it to her, Robert?
If I'm not mistaken, I think it came from. I'm wanting to say it was my. It would have been my great grandmother off of my grandfather's side.
So she must have been upset with her, I guess, huh?
Well, I don't think so. I've never, as far as bad blood in our family, we've always been a close-knit family. My understanding is she had inherited it from somebody or another. I don't remember how she had came across it to give to my grandmother. And I just know that the stories were, I mean, because she had had it up till I was at a young age because my grandparents had brought me up. But apparently when they put the mirror up in the hallway, everybody said you'd walk through the hallway and just get these cold chills.
Yeah, eerie feeling.
And it was just like, kind of trying to figure it out. Me talking about it now, I'm getting chills running down my backside. But eventually, my great uncle, off of my grandmother's side, he was an ordained minister, and he looked at it one day and just looked at my grandmother and said, "You have to get rid of this mirror."
Wow.
And she said, "Why?" And he said, "There's something not right about this."
He knew.
And I remember, yeah, and I remember that my grandfather took it out to a friend of his that had a big old farm and took it out in the middle of the woods and actually dug a hole. I think they dug it almost about as deep as you would bury somebody, 6 foot deep.
Jeez.
And put this mirror down in the hole. And I don't know if it was salt they sprinkled on it, but they threw something else in the hole and covered it up. And that was all I ever seen of that mirror. But after the mirror was out of the house, the eerie feeling of walking down the hallway was gone. The tension sometimes it would build up, the depressed feelings of, some of the people in the family, they said
that went away too.
So yeah, I can kind of verify cursed items too. And it's just, one of them things, and people need to learn that, there is a spiritual, as far as the Christianity belief goes,
of course it is.
But you also have other things that we can't comprehend, because as he said, Joshua said, our limit to seeing and hearing things are so narrow. As human beings, we are very narrow-minded.
If we could hear and pick up other dimensions, this would be an amazing universe, to be sure. We're going to come back in a moment and take final phone calls with Joshua P. Warren, our pre-Christmas Eve show. Don't forget, we're live on Christmas Eve and on Christmas night, right here on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest, Joshua P. Warren, we'll take your calls. Ghostly Christmas stories, or have you seen Santa? And welcome back to Coast, Joshua Warren with us. Joshua, so what are you going to do for Christmas? You're going to be in Puerto Rico?
Yes, indeed. I am. I'm here with, again, filmmaker C. Eric Scott, and we are editing a feature that we shot earlier this year, an independent film based on a pirate ghost story here in the Caribbean. And you're actually going to see me on screen.
There we go.
We'll see how that works out. And then, of course, I'm doing a lot of traveling and promotion. You may have seen I have a new novel that just recently came out called The Gringo Maniac Murder Spree, which one reviewer described as the Coen Brothers meets E.T. So it's about these kind of two conspiracy-fueled guys on a rampage killing bad guys in order to save an alien being, the most powerful being in the universe. And so that's been a fun thing to write, and I'm going to start traveling to promote that before next month. I head down to Mexico on the Conspira Sea Cruise, and I don't know if that is sold out or not, but if anybody wants to hang out with me in January, JoshuaPWarren.com has all the details under the news section.
All right, let's go to the calls. And Skype's open, by the way, at George97313. Mike in Whittier, California. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi there.
This call is concerning goblins opposed to ghosts. From another Charles Dickens classic, he wrote a number of Christmas stories, and I just wanted to bring that up since you were talking about Charles Dickens and Christmas
works.
Carol. This one is about a fellow, Gabriel Grubb, who was a gravedigger, and on Christmas Eve, he had to get his job done, and these goblins, they took him through one of those, I guess, surreal-type adventures. It wasn't three different ghosts, but these goblins really turned him around and woke him up as to his attitude. But I just wanted to, you know, just
great
add that to the
thank
whole
you, Michael.
Charles Dickens.
Very good. Appreciate that. It seems that Halloween pulls out more ghosts of stories, Josh, than Christmas.
Well, yeah, you know, yeah, Halloween, of course, is when that transition is being made. You know, in Halloween time, I mean, basically what's happening is the Earth is moving away from the sun in our part of the world, and so it changes dramatically the electromagnetic environment, and it allows literally some of these energies, these subtle paranormal energies that were being sort of literally repressed by the radiation of the sun to sort of come forth and become more prevalent. And so by the time Christmas gets here, it's reached a whole new extreme orientation. And so now we have all of these, you know, beings that are in their prime sort of operating capacity. And you have to also realize that most of these ghostly or spiritual things, not all of them, but most of them seem to manifest more prominently when you have better conditions for high electrostatic charge. And, you know, we've talked a lot about this over the years. I can go into my laboratory at the Asheville Mystery Museum and using Van de Graaff generators and Wimshurst machines and devices that produce electrostatic charge, reproduce a lot of the characteristics people ordinarily attribute to ghosts. We can create three-dimensional light forms. We can create the sensation of physical touch when nothing is there. We can move objects without touching them. We can make your hair stand up on end. We can give you goosebumps. We can do all these things artificially. And it, I think, is no coincidence that when these ghosts appear, the conditions are often also ideal for these heightened electrostatic charges. So I feel that in the wintertime, when in most places it's starting to get really cold and very dry, the kind of environment in this country when, you know, you pull the blankets up at night and you can see the little lightning bolts go crackling all over the place, or you drag your socks across the floor and you get a shock off the doorknob. When you have those kinds of conditions, like we have normally in the winter, it creates a prime electrostatic environment with all this sort of free-floating available energy that these beings either tend to utilize in order to have a physical interface with us, or it somehow is an opportunity for them, that this energy is there, and it simply gives us an ability to see what is always there, but we're not usually able to detect.
Next up, Barry's in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hey, Barry.
Hello there, George. You knew it was me, and gosh knows it's Joshua P. Warren. What a guy. I love him to death.
He's close to your neck of the woods.
That's exactly right. As a matter of fact, I'm only 2 hours from Asheville, Josh, and I just wanted to tell you that I can't wait for you to get back to Asheville. Tell me when you're going to be back, because I want to come up there and come to the museum and meet you. And then I don't know about next August. We'll see what happens then. But when are you coming home?
Well, thank you for asking, Barry, and always good to talk to a fellow Carolinian. And, you know, well, at this point, I'm kind of a little bit up in the air with my travel schedule.
And he will come and meet you, Josh. Trust me.
Okay, I believe it. So I'm thinking...
When you come home, I'll be there the next day.
Well, you know, I have a lady who already tells me she's my number one fan and my stalker, so maybe number two will work. But yeah, I as a matter of fact, I'll probably be back sometime in the spring. On the other hand, I bounce back and forth in and out a lot, so it's hard for me to say exactly when I'll be back. But you just go to my website and send me an email, and I'll let you know.
Believe me, I can find out where you are. As a matter of fact, I just pulled you up this morning, and that's a fascinating new book you got out. I haven't read it, of course, because I just heard about it today. What was it called?
The new novel is called The Gringo Maniac Murder Spree.
Yep.
And I kind of wrote it like one of these Quentin Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez type of really action-packed films. And as a matter of fact, yes, we already have some serious interest from some folks in Hollywood.
Wow.
So we're waiting to see how that turns out. But it was a fun thing because I like to write fiction occasionally in addition to all my nonfiction books.
Well, I tell you what, yeah, you're some kind of dynamo. You remind me of that Linda Moulton Howe. And as George knows, the world's greatest storyteller is Lionel Fanthorpe.
That's right, and he'll be on tomorrow night with us doing his...
Oh, God, that was my next question, George. When will he be on next?
He's going to be doing his 'Twas the Night Before Christmas rendition for us.
Oh, I've heard it three or four times, and I'll be there listening.
You got it. Thanks, Barry.
I'll take a nap and wake up in time to hear
the show. you do that, and don't forget our Christmas show, too, as well. I love broadcasting on the holidays, Josh. It's very special.
Well, it's absolutely amazing that you do that. I mean, in fact, I have conversations all the time with other people in broadcasting who say that they really admire you for doing that. As a matter of fact, earlier tonight, I made an appearance on Dave Schrader's program.
Oh, yeah.
His radio.
Our colleague.
And, yeah, and I was talking to his producer, Tim, and I said, you know, I'm going to be on George's show later tonight. I said, you know, he's going to be broadcasting as usual on Christmas, and we had this big conversation about how truly incredible that is. And I think it provides, you know, how big of a service that you're providing for people out there who really, they feel, even though they may have never met you, that you're their friend and you are their family for the holidays.
Well, and that's exactly why we do it, Josh. It's a pledge I made 13 years ago, and you know, we're going to do it. If a holiday falls on a regular scheduled night for me, I'm going to do it. If it falls on a weekend, our weekend folks will do it. If they can't, I'll do it. But we'll always have a live program on holidays. That's our pledge.
And also, when it comes to these negative things we were talking about, how some people get depressed,
mm-hmm.
It shows you that it's even more needed. So I commend you and thank you for doing that.
First-time caller, Art in Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Art, go ahead, sir.
Oh, boy, I got one for you that you're not going to believe.
All right.
I'm not sure I'm right on that. I want to ask you a question first. I'm sure you know all about orbs.
He does.
Yeah.
No, you, right?
I do, too, but
yeah,
not as much as Josh.
Okay. You're not going to believe what happened. We had a Christmas party, a big Christmas family party. There was about 30 to 40 people there, and they were taking pictures and so forth. And then my niece says, "Geez, something's wrong with my camera. I got dust on the lens." I said, "What are you talking about?" So she showed me a couple. I said, "Are you kidding? Those are orbs." They went from two to three on some pictures to like 20 to 30 on others. And nobody saw anything. Nobody knew anything until she checked, you know, her pictures because she was having trouble with her camera. She saw it. And we just had them for at least a half hour. They'd go from large to small. Some of them as small as a dot, like a period. And then some of them as big as a basketball. it was just incredible. And I just wanted to find out something about it because I couldn't believe what I was seeing. You know, and as I say, we have at least 10 to 12 or more full pictures of them coming and going and coming and going and coming and going. And what I think happened, I think the hostess is the one that got that thing going. She found some old pictures and she put them up on the wall so we could all see the people that had passed and, you know, just other old pictures of whoever. And there was a lot of the people had passed away. I'd say probably at least 10 or so, or maybe a little bit more. And I think that they were them coming back to the party.
They might be. Your take, Josh, on orbs.
Yeah, well, you know, Art, I'm glad that you asked this question because unlike a lot of people in the paranormal field, I enjoy talking about orbs. And here's why. There are many, many things, both paranormal and normal, that can create orbs. And because of that, a lot of researchers just kind of dismiss them out of hand and say, well, they're dust or they're moisture and or reflections, that kind of thing. And yes, in many cases they are. But there are paranormal orbs that are quite extraordinary. And here is an experiment that I did, and I implore anybody else who's in the field of research to repeat this so you'll know that I'm telling you the truth. If you take an electrostatic generator, like a Van de Graaff machine, and you take it to a typical house where, say, you know, a ghost hunt might be done, and you turn the lights low, especially if you have night shot, you turn that on, and then for the very first time, you fire up the machine, you will see orbs go shooting away from the electrostatic generator. Now, the reason this happens is that when this electrostatic field is produced, it immediately attracts all of the airborne particles and it condenses them into a clump of matter. And that matter shows up on camera as an orb. So when you go to a traditional haunted place and you start picking up these anomalous electrostatic fields where the ghosts are seen, it makes sense that you would see an orb, because the electrostatic field associated with the ghost, which is an anomalous field in this context, is also attracting these airborne particles. And so what you end up with is sort of what you might think of as a ghost's flying dust footprint. And that's why these particular orbs, they move in all of these extraordinary ways. And if you put a hairdryer or something like that there, or a fan, they should always move in the direction of the airflow unless they're being affected by something else. And in many cases, that's what happens. The way they move is not affected by airflow alone. They're attracted to this strong field that keeps them intact. So in other words, sometimes when you get these different orbs, what you're really seeing is a true little glimpse of a larger spiritual being there that has a field around it. That field is not showing up on camera, but the part of the field that's attracting the matter and condensing it is what does show up on camera as an orb, and that's why orb research should be taken seriously.
Joshua, do holidays bring out more strange occurrences, demons, entities?
Yeah, you know, holidays in general do, because you know, what we really have to ultimately look at here is the reality that you might see the world as a place where things can be somehow, quote-unquote, objectively documented or, quote-unquote, subjectively perceived. And that may be true to a certain extent, but humans create scientific instruments. Humans build those instruments. Humans calibrate those instruments. Humans use those instruments. Humans interpret those. You cannot remove the subjective human component and the fact that all information gets first processed through the human nervous system. And so whenever humans are in an excitable state, as they are around the holidays, when they are usually jubilant or they're celebrating, they are producing an enormous amount of energy, then even though within that bubble, that produces a lot of positive, good activity, that positivity is going to inevitably attract the darker things, and also right there on the boundary, things that may or may not be good or bad, but are simply sort of dimensional shifts that are occurring and moving and slipping and sliding all around that condense energy due to that polarizing aspect that we talked about earlier in the show.
Josh, with the moments that we have left, will you tell people where they can track you and read up on some of your works?
Absolutely. Thank you, George. My website is joshuapwarren.com. There is a gallery of the strange there where you can see all kinds of interesting images and video clips. If you go to the homepage and sign up for my free e-newsletter, you will instantly receive a free good luck charm that will be sent to you through your email. And people love that, and I get great emails from people who say that's improved their lives. And also, I hope that you'll scroll down on the homepage and look at that picture of the supposed gargula and tell me what you think. And I am offering a reward to anybody who can tell me where that picture came from. But again, all that and a lot more at joshuapwarren.com.
All right, my friend. Have a great Christmas in Puerto Rico and stay safe, Josh. Really appreciate everything you do for us. For Dan Galante, Jihun Lee, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Morrison, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.